This is a Triple J podcast.
What do you do if someone you love gets caught up in a web of mis or disinformation that's not only removed from reality, but is potentially putting their health at risk? When do you call it out? When does your concern risk isolating them? But when does your support risk turning into complicity? I'm Dave Marchese. This is Hack's Long Listen of the Week, a chat with Hannah McElhinney. Now, Hannah's got a really interesting story. She got sent on a massive journey after something tragic happened to her cousin Lauren. Lauren believed she had a debilitating condition and she was going to extreme methods to try to heal herself.
We started to understand the treatment that she had undergone and what had happened to her.
Lauren died after getting caught up in an alternative medicine wormhole. It was a big shock to the family and enough to get Hannah looking into how this happened.
Flung myself into intensive, obsessive research to try and understand what had happened to her.
Now Hannah's written a book tracing her journey, and it's not only an interesting story, but a bit of a warning to others. At a time when society's growing mistrust of the medical establishment is sending people down their own wormholes.
I got to know Lauren so much better after her death than I ever did while she was alive. That has been a real motivating force to talk about this a bit more.
Yeah, this is a really useful listen, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to connect with this story. Even if their experience isn't exactly the same, it's definitely going to resonate with those unsure how to help someone they love who's caught in a trap of distrust and misinformation. Here's my chat with author Hannah McElhinney about her book Wormhole. Hannah McElhinney, welcome to Hack.
Thank you so much for having me.
Look, people might actually know you from Rainbow History Class, a social media channel all about queer and trans history. This is a bit different, though.
It is. It is a sharp turn, although with some, I guess, underlying shared themes.
Yeah. I mean, the book is fascinating and just very immersive. Like, I was caught in it and just a real page turner. I wanted to find out what happened. Let's explore the story of your cousin, Lauren. Can you tell us a bit more about her and what she was like?
Yeah, so Lauren was my older cousin. She was 5 years older than me, and she embodied the quintessential older 90s cool girl, you know, Hanson boy band posters all over her bedroom walls, nail art. She was, I guess, what many people look up to in kind of a, I guess, an older family member sense. The other side of that was I also remember her being quite sleepy, which is an interesting thing to remember. But a lot of my memories of seeing Lauren around school holidays or Christmas involved needing to wait for her to wake up.
So did Lauren always think that she was unwell? That was something you remember from childhood.
So prior to her being about 16 years old or 15, it was really just this kind of accepted conversation that teenagers slept a lot and, you know, Lauren was becoming a teenager and that's just what happened. But this was excessive. There was very little awareness around certain chronic illnesses in the early 2000s. And so it wasn't until Lauren was in her later teenage years, about 16 years old or 15, where she noticed that she could bend over, like hunch her shoulders forward, and it would make an audible cracking sound. And that would cause her pain, discomfort. And so she would go to see physios and massage therapists, and that really started her journey into getting kind of her first two diagnoses over those years, which was chronic fatigue syndrome or ME/CFS and fibromyalgia.
So when was it that Lauren kind of changed her thinking and believed that she had something else? Because later she decided it was chronic Lyme disease. When did that switch happen?
That was much later. So that would have been in the years pre-COVID, around maybe 2018 is when she kind of found that diagnosis. And in between then and those early diagnoses, she looked into a range of other conditions, things like POTS, those hard to define, mysterious chronic conditions that are invisible in their symptoms, or their symptoms might be inconsistent or change. She was looking into those types of diagnoses. But when she discovered chronic Lyme, which I should say here is a contested diagnosis around the world. So in the United States, for example, particularly the East Coast where Lyme disease is endemic, medical authorities there will still contest the diagnosis of chronic Lyme. They sort of talk about post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which is where the active infection has left a person's system, but maybe they've got ongoing symptoms. But here in Australia, our medical authorities don't recognize Lyme disease as endemic. They have not been able to identify ticks here that carry the Lyme disease bacteria. And so because of that, there is a group of people who are experiencing these symptoms, neurological symptoms, pain, fatigue, those symptoms that are consistent with Lyme disease symptoms, that are advocating strongly for, I guess, more inquiry into this area. And they do argue that chronic Lyme disease does in fact exist.
It's a really controversial topic. And I mean, over the years in Australia, there have been inquiries into this, looking into it. I think health experts here say that there are no proven cases of Lyme disease being caught in Australia. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
So what sort of treatments was Lauren using to try and treat this chronic Lyme disease, which she believed that she had?
So all sorts, to the extent that when my family recovered her possessions after she'd died, they found bags and bags and bags of all sorts of pills and substances. But to give you a sense of some of the things that she would take or try. So the first thing is veterinary ivermectin. So this is something that rose in popularity during the COVID years, but something that Lauren was taking beforehand. She was definitely ahead of the Maha movement in what she was taking. So ivermectin is an antiparasitic medication that is used in humans in certain countries where there are issues with illnesses like river blindness, but ultimately it's used a lot in cattle drench or sheep dip, so that antiparasitic solution that you would drench livestock in to kill any parasites. It's not intended to be ingested at all. There are influencers in this space, and they really advocate for people to find this ivermectin. They recommend horse ivermectin, equine ivermectin, as the strongest, best version of it, and they will encourage you to add that to morning smoothies and things like that. So wow, this really, really heavy chemical type under the kitchen sink, I guess, ingredients should look at chlorine dioxide, which is often sold under another name, MMS. What that is chlorine dioxide, which is bleach. So it's used typically to bleach paper, but Lauren would drink that in a smoothie. And there are many, many people online that advocate, you know, people taking chlorine dioxide to fix all kinds of horrible illnesses that, of course, it doesn't. Other things I found, bee sting therapy. So
what's
Lauren
that?
Would,
what's so bee sting therapy?
Bee sting therapy is a therapy where a person will sting themselves repeatedly with bees to try and treat Lyme disease. And then there's a few other types of things. So diets, this big one called Gerson therapy, which was popularized by Bell Gibson.
There's a lot of stuff there. I mean, what kind of impact was it having on her physically, but also socially as well? Like, having such a regimented system there, she must have seemed a bit socially isolated, I would think.
Absolutely. When you're following these protocols, particularly things like Gerson therapy, which means that you can't eat really anything that's not organic, you need to be doing 5 coffee enemas a day. Those types of things meant that she wasn't able to kind of go far from home because she'd need to do these enemas or juicing. And so that means that you are kind of really restricting yourself. There's also, with some of these more dangerous treatments, so with drinking bleach and, you know, sheep dip. That comes with a lot of side effects. And so for somebody in Lauren's situation, you have no idea about whether or not the side effects are making you sick or whether or not you think these treatments are helping. They will often in these circles talk about herxing, which is a response that does have some basis in medical science, but it's essentially a reaction where having a treatment, as it kills off parasites in your system, you will experience an increase in symptoms. And while that is true for certain conditions and certain antibiotics, what that does is set the precedent for anyone to say, hey, try this treatment. And if you feel worse after taking it, that's a sign it's working.
Hannah, did you and your family know that Lauren was undergoing all of these treatments and putting herself through this?
Yes, to an extent. So my dad did know, my auntie knew, and was, of course, extremely concerned about it. But then there was also a bit of, I guess, family law that what she was doing was ridiculous or just wacko. We sort of had this idea of, you know, what's Lauren doing now? There was a time when her and I were quite connected because the things she was looking at, in particular around gut health, I also was really interested in and was trying at this particular time. So it really got extreme more slowly. And I think, yes, Lauren was known as someone who was trying the latest thing. That wasn't necessarily seen as a malevolent force until she was deeply into it.
Lauren ended up dying. And she was seeking treatment at the time overseas. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, so Lauren had gone to Malaysia to the port city of Johor Bahru, which is just over the other side of the Singapore border. Nobody knew that she was going from our family. So the first time my auntie discovered that she had gone overseas was when a man that Lauren had been living with contacted Lauren's older sister and said, I need to get in touch with Lauren's mother. This happened over Facebook, and this man who my auntie didn't know basically said Lauren is in a large hospital in Johor Bahru and she's unconscious. She can't be brought out of the coma. Over those coming days, we started to understand the treatment that she had undergone and what had happened to her.
In the book, you write, when Lauren died, among the shock and sadness, I felt recognition. I saw myself in her and now I see her everywhere I look. The story has become my parasite, my haunting, my warning. What do you mean by that?
When she had died, I think there was an initial shock of just what a horrific thing to have happened. But I noticed that I started to see connections. I started to think, well, hang on, Lauren didn't just wake up one day and think, I'm going to go and have drastic alternative medical treatment. She'd been making her way down this path for a long time. And I looked at things like algorithms, social media, things that I was seeing in culture, and I started to get the sense that Lauren was really a symptom of a broader system and that she wouldn't be the only one who had taken such a tragic leap. And so I just found that I couldn't shake it. I think it was probably a way of grieving. I flung myself into intensive, obsessive research to try and understand what had happened to her. I got into the Facebook groups that she was posting in and operating in. And I sort of started to follow these digital footsteps. And as somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder, when I say I became obsessed with it, I mean that in that context.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, your investigation. Like you say, you ended up looking at her social accounts, who she was following, what kind of information she was being served up. And in the book you say, yeah, Lauren's death did not occur in a vacuum, but a wormhole. What's a wormhole? It's the title of your book. What do you think that means?
It's something with layered meaning, but this idea of, I think, these algorithmic forces that suck us further into an area of the internet that we don't necessarily have control over or feel we have control over. And that's something that I certainly experienced. Gosh, you start investigating this for one day, 2 days, and, you know, I'm still clearing the parasite cleanse ads from my social media feeds. And then the other area is this idea of time, because when we look at it in almost sci-fi way, if you go through a wormhole, you're sort of sucked into a place where time doesn't exist. And that's something that when I found different people that were in different stages of living with chronic, invisible or mysterious illnesses, I did find that a lot of them actually had a really challenging time working out where their illness started and finished, what the shape of it was, what the chronology of it was. And then the third meaning is parasites. At the end of the day, this is a book about an obsession with parasites, both literal ones in what Lauren felt that she had, but then also from my own experience with OCD and feeling those kind of obsessive or pathological need to check or find things out, that I experienced that like a parasite as well.
It's a good word. I mean, yeah, it's a good title. It encompasses a lot in there. And I mean, there's so much to unpack in this story. As part of your investigation, you actually tracked down the doctor who performed Lauren's procedure in Malaysia. Can you tell us more about what happened, like what led up to her death and what you were able to find out about that doctor?
I think what's interesting here is that a lot of people have asked, how did you get all of this information from this doctor Radzi? And the answer to that is he gave it to us. I was shocked to find that he was a respected oncologist with a lot of legitimate medical training in Malaysia and abroad. And so although it was strange that Lauren saw him, she didn't have cancer, and an oncologist does not really treat infectious diseases, let alone ones that are disputed as a diagnosis. It turns out he was offering a particular treatment, which is the one that Lauren underwent. Essentially, it's called hypothermia. And what they do is you are in something akin to a sort of solarium bed, I guess would be the best way of describing it. What happens is your body is heated to a very high temperature, at which point it's thought that the bacteria, the Lyme disease-causing bacteria, would die off. They wouldn't be able to survive. There is some science and evidence for using hypothermia in very particular cases. For example, in late-stage cancer, where you might be infusing warm chemotherapy solution, which is said to maybe make the chemotherapy more effective in certain cases. But really what we're talking about here is a sort of extraction of the idea of it and then an extrapolation of it into something that will can kill you like it did Lauren. But what happened to her is, yeah, her body was heated up to 42 degrees, which is the required temperature for this treatment of Lyme disease. It continued to rise. It reached, you know, 42.5 degrees. Her body was held there for multiple hours. And then the idea is that a person cools down naturally. However, we know that you're in a pretty significant health situation if your body temperature starts to get up towards 40. So above that is extremely dangerous.
So in the course of your investigation, were you able to find other people who had also become very sick or passed away?
You know, anecdotally, what I found was people very much towing the line of, this did not work for me, but I've heard it worked for so many other people. I spoke to one person who knew someone who'd undergone this particular procedure and had severe burns, but I wasn't able to find anybody that had met an end like Lauren did, although there are people that experienced very severe side effects. So, for example, the doctor who performed it did talk about another patient that did experience kidney failure after, I don't know what happened to that person. So, yeah, there are stories around, and there are people that credit it for improving their symptoms, but it's entirely unregulated, so it's impossible to know.
Are these procedures still being practiced now?
Absolutely, they are still being practiced. While this doctor, Radzi, is not performing them as openly as he was. There is a way to get him, you know, kind of via a back door, via WhatsApp. And then in Germany, there is a very well-known clinic there that will do it and was recently frequented by the Hadids, who are probably the most well-known cases of chronic Lyme disease.
Wow. Okay. There is so much to unpack. I mean, on this journey, do you feel like you got to know your cousin, Lauren, a bit more? Did you understand a little more how she ended up in the situation she did? Like, I know you talk about an infodemic in your book, like research finding more than half of social media posts about vaccines contained misinformation. On this investigation, did it all start to make a bit more sense about how people get caught up in this?
Yeah. I think the saddest thing for me was I got to know Lauren so much better after her death than I ever did while she was alive. And that has been a real motivating force to kind of talk about this a bit more, because I thought of her as, you know, a bit of a conspiracy theorist. You know, everybody is got one in their family. But when I started to look at what happened to her and I put it into a timeline, I actually found that everything that she did, there was a truth at the beginning of it and there was a reason that she did it. And while a lot of it was based on misinformation, her logical steps were ones that I think so many people would take, especially if you're experiencing chronic pain or mysterious illnesses, or if you are a woman, or if you are Indigenous, or if you are a person of color, or any other marginalized by medicine group, you are even more vulnerable, because not only you might be experiencing symptoms, but you might be having those symptoms dismissed by mainstream medicine.
So do you think Lauren was let down by the healthcare system, essentially?
Absolutely, in two ways. The first way, because her symptoms weren't believed or validated when she took them to, you know, those frontline health professionals. This is a systemic issue, certainly not one with individual practitioners, because there are so many people doing wonderful work. But from a systemic point of view, I think there's a lack of information, a lack of understanding about these conditions, and these are conditions that are more likely to affect those in female bodies. And then the second part of it was that when Lauren was further down this wormhole, my auntie would take her to, I guess you would call it, mainstream specialists, cardiologists, or, you know, infectious diseases specialists, to just sense check some of the treatments that she was seeking out herself. And for my auntie, she desperately wanted someone from the medical field to intervene and engage. But so often, and understandably, they feared getting entangled in alternative medicine. You know, they don't want to lose their registration or anything like that. Many of them just kind of hands up, shut down, not like fingers in their ears. I'm not talking about this. In particular, one doctor sort of rolled their eyes at my auntie over Lauren's head while she was talking about some of the treatments that she was looking at. So there is this unwillingness to engage. And while I understand why, it's the removal of a point that could have kept that person connected to evidence-based treatment.
It's kind of a hard line as someone on the outside with a loved one. And as you say, there's probably someone listening now who can relate to this and has their own family or friend who is maybe going down a wormhole and they don't know how to best deal with it. Do you have any advice on that? Because, you know, it's, you want to support a person, but you also don't want to entertain dangerous ideas. You want to call stuff out, but you also don't want to isolate them.
Absolutely. And I think I have things that I would like to change about my own behavior. None of those things are going to, you know, bring Lauren back. But where I think we can focus our efforts as family members is the invalidation that people with these illnesses often feel. We can address that by just believing in the symptoms of our loved ones, even if we can't see them. It can be very frustrating to people in their lives when you don't understand what a loved one's going through and why they might be okay one minute, but the next minute they might be in severe pain. That frustration comes out of care. But if we can just make sure that we believe their symptoms, we validate their symptoms, and that they know that we are committed to supporting them as they find something that will help them, I think that goes a long way. We're also really socialized to see illness as a restitution narrative. We're so used to seeing kind of painkiller ads on TV where a person has a symptom, takes some medication, and then they feel all of a sudden better. You know, their hay fever is gone, their period pain has evaporated. And so we're not actually very good at sitting with narratives that don't follow a clean, neat storyline. So if we can just kind of hold space for that, I think that's one thing. And then the next thing is watching our language. I am certainly someone that used, you know, language like kooks or quacks, anti-vaxxers, putting kind of value judgments on certain ways of thinking. However, what that can mean is we can risk shaming our loved ones into concealment. They don't want to hear an I told you so. So perhaps when they do feel that a treatment is not working for them, or maybe they've spent a lot of money on a certain treatment and they're starting to feel uncomfortable, maybe, you know, that practitioner is not, you know, who they said they are, then they might not feel comfortable having that open conversation if we've all of a sudden called that practitioner a grifter. And there's plenty of alternative medicines that might not be standard care, but they're also not dangerous.
Look, it's a great read and very engaging. I highly recommend it. It's called Wormhole. Author Hannah McElhenney, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and if you do want to read Hannah's book, it is called Wormhole and is out now. And if you like these long listens, please subscribe to this podcast. We do have interviews, deep dives, plus our daily radio show dropping every single week. That's all for now. I'll catch you next time.